This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, another batch of Wall Street big banks reporting today. The news giving, well, it was giving a lift, another lift to the trade. We're talking about Goldman Sachs and Bank of America. Thank you, Apple, for bringing the markets down.
Yeah. As we said, well, there's a lot going on, Carol, today.
Yeah.
But let's stick with Bank of America, excuse me, because that's a really important one. We got Catherine Doherty joining us now, finance reporter for Bloomberg News. She's been in since the wee hours of the morning covering these companies, among them Bank of America. She's with us now in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So Bank of America is reaping the benefits of a rate rise, but they're also having to pay up for the use of unapproved personal devices. Give us the big takeaway from today's report.
So big takeaway, it's actually reflective in Bank of America and then across Wall Street. We started to see this last week when first Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan were reporting. And then when Wells and Citi came out on Friday, we expected that the focus, which it was today with Bank of America, would be on NII growth. So every time...
You're talking net interest income.
Yes, net interest income. So now that rates have risen, the banks are able to take in... Their lending practices are becoming more profitable. The estimates across the major banks for Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, JP Morgan, they all exceeded analyst expectations. However, they've been impacted by expenses and fines. So you referenced it really is particular to Bank of America, and the other banks have either already disclosed a $200 million fine or they're starting to reference this probe with regulators with regards to device use.
What the heck is this about? Just tell me, because it's like been coming across and we're like, what?
Don't freaking text your friends about what you're doing at work from your mobile device.
It's simply,
right? Is that what it is?
The use of personal devices.
Okay,
yes, so. Your cell phone.
Okay.
And if they're not disclosed or if it's outside of your work phone. So this is across all the banks, but we're just starting to see it really be talked about, and that we're expecting a full settlement to come with the big number.
Well, okay, what's surprising to me is that this is happening in 2022 versus like 2015,
right?
Because it's not like, you know, people were using, we're talking like WhatsApp, Signal, any messaging service that we use to send messages to one another, right?
This is the same app.
So why is this an issue now and it wasn't an issue 7 years ago?
But it was, I thought it was such also a clampdown following the financial meltdown.
This SEC and the CFTC are both, this is, I think, the closure of it all.
Okay.
They're just really honing in, and it was after Archegos, we started to hear it talked about a little bit more. Mm-hmm. That brought this back into the attention of regulators. So they basically went back to all the banks, saw that it was still a practice they needed to clamp down on, and this is the end result.
Does this also include when you guys talk with like folks in the financial community that they can't be talking to you on their cell phones and stuff? Like, where does... what does this encompass?
Who are your sources, Kat?
No, you know what I'm saying? Does that mean, too, in terms of how they communicate? Because that's an interesting area.
It's full-on communication, but I believe that the communication is with regards to deals that they are working on, and if they're talking to, you know, if it has, it really depends on the party.
Does there have to be a potential for, like, possible financial payoff? And not payoff, but you know what I mean? Benefit or something?
We haven't seen anything come out to say that there's been instances that the regulators are going to point out. But perhaps in the future, when a settlement is publicly disclosed and the regulators come out and say, this is our findings, that's something we'll be looking for.
It's so funny, Carol, because if you think about just the way, you know, anecdotally, the way that you and I interact, for example, sometimes I'll text you, sometimes I'll send you an IB, sometimes I'll call you on your cell phone.
Right.
And it's like, you know, if we were working at a bank, how might that be different? And we're always talking like about the show.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Like, couldn't you be having a meeting with somebody and put something on a napkin?
So,
like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's interesting. Do people go back to those kinds of ways of communicating? Because it's...
You're never going to capture all communication, right? But I think that the main focus here is, are you communicating on your work devices or your personal devices? And the regulators are concerned that they were seeing more use of the personal devices, that maybe it wasn't even you were doing something bad. They were just seeing that the use was up and that it was work-related. It was starting, I believe, with some of these previous, a year ago, 2 years ago, probes that they started to see communication go offline.
Okay, we only have 30 seconds left. What do we learn about the American consumer from Bank of America?
They say the consumer is resilient.
Okay.
Yes.
That's good.
We're printing up consumers are resilient t-shirts, right?
Yeah, but do not send messages that the consumer is resilient on your personal device.
I was going to say consumers are resilient, and then you go on the back and you're like, but for how long? Right?
Right. No, that's what we're watching for next. This is just the data from this past 3 months, but we'll see what the second half of the year has to bring.
This was fun. Get some sleep. I know. Do you get some sleep tonight?
Yeah. Okay. I will.
All right. Kat Daugherty. She's finance reporter at Bloomberg News. I love our finance team all across Bloomberg, man.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Among the most read on the Bloomberg Terminal, it's also a story that will be featured in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week, which is due out later this week on newsstands. Already, though, as we said, on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Such a relevant story to our world, Tim. It's about how the U.S. is exporting inflation, and it's probably going to get worse.
Because the Fed hikes, Carol. Ben Holland writes all about it with our other colleagues, Enda Curran and Alexander Weber. Ben joins us this afternoon. He's economics editor for Bloomberg News. He's on the phone from our Washington, D.C. bureau. Ben, what does it mean when you write that the U.S. is exporting inflation? What does that mean?
Well, so I think it's happening in two ways. So the first thing is that all over the world in the pandemic, you had this kind of change in what people were buying, right? So people weren't buying gym memberships, they weren't buying restaurant meals, they weren't going on vacation so much, they were buying goods. They were buying exercise bikes and TV sets. But this shift was much bigger in the United States than in other countries, and it's lasted for longer. And it's been amplified by the way that some of the big U.S. retailers have been behaving, because we know now that people like Walmart and Target built up huge inventories of stuff. So they were basically buying even more stuff than American consumers wanted to buy, which was already a lot. And because supplies of all these goods, which are traded on global markets, were constrained by COVID, the effect of Americans buying so much of them was to push their prices up for other countries, too.
Also joining us, of course, is Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week, and he's here in our Interactive Broker studio. Hey, Joel.
Hi. So, Ben, I wanted to ask you, you know, how is this manifesting itself? You know, we've seen what happens when, you know, we get a glut of inventory in America, and if this is getting pushed out, like, how is it showing up elsewhere?
So it does show up in the inflation numbers in other countries, but if you look at a place like Europe, then, of course, in the headline numbers, this effect is swamped because, you know, the biggest driver of higher inflation is energy and food, you know, a lot of which is the result of the Ukraine war. But you are seeing higher prices of imported goods by comparison with goods that are produced domestically in European countries. And then the new side of it that we're starting to see now, of course, is that the fix to this, you know, this problem, if you want a very strong American demand, is higher American interest rates. Well, that is knocking the dollar much higher. We now have like a very, very strong dollar. And that makes the inflation problem for other countries even worse in a way, because it means that stuff they buy from America or stuff that is priced in dollars like oil and other commodities also become more expensive for them.
And I feel like, you know, this is not something that it's a touch and go, Ben. And this is why we continue to see the inflationary problems globally, you know, sticking with us even longer than maybe we had all hoped.
Yeah, I think so, because this is something that could outlast some of the other causes of inflation. So even if European energy and food problems were to sort of magically disappear, or if they were, you know, that inflation was to fade away, this other stuff caused by a strong dollar, for example, might still be around, and it might still keep inflation higher than the central bankers in Europe would be comfortable with.
Okay, so the Fed pretty much going to keep raising rates for a while. So how much worse is this problem going to get, Ben?
I mean, it could potentially get worse. I mean, the caveat, of course, is that, you know, as I said, the headline inflation in places like Europe is really an energy story. But it could be that even when that goes away, that they are still left with a problem, which is caused by, you know, first strong American demand, and then second the very strong dollar that makes their life harder. And another thing to think about here is that it also makes the job of a central banker harder. Because if you're the American central bank, and you think that American inflation is at least partly being caused by strong American demand, well, that's something you can do something about. When you raise interest rates, you'll be addressing that. But it leaves the European Central Bank, for example, in a situation where their inflation is not being caused by, you know, European consumers going out and buying lots of stuff, and yet they still feel like they have to raise rates, and the result might be that they just slow their economy down without really doing much to address the root of the problem.
Why did Americans buy stuff at a different rate than other countries during the pandemic, Ben? Look, we know Americans love their stuff. We know we have different lifestyles in terms of the type of houses that we live in and what we have inside those houses. But was it a function of the length of lockdowns or changing demographic patterns here in the U.S.? Is there an explanation for it?
Because we're really good at delivery, Tim.
Sometimes. We're not good at delivery startups.
Well, I think, you know, as you said, part of it is just that the patterns of what people buy are different in different countries to start with before the pandemic. But I think in the pandemic, probably the biggest reason why that shift was, you know, was bigger and longer lasting in America was that the United States did a bigger fiscal stimulus than European countries, for example. Because it couldn't really have been that the other side of it, the supply stuff, you know, it was harder to do here because you know, more restaurants were closed in Europe than the United States, right? So,
yeah, it's a really good point. And the difference is, I mean, this is why we watch kind of global central bank policy right now. Like, the differences that we will see around the world is going to create problems and certainly different investing environments as a result. One of the things I love in your story is you talk about the two economies may have similar rates of inflation. You're talking about Europe and the U.S., but they have different kinds with major implications, again, for how the banks tackle the problem. But you talk about, you know, the distinction boiling down to how big a share of price pressures is homegrown. And we really need to look at internally where the inflationary pressures are within each country.
Yeah, and what you see when you do look at that, I think, is really reinforces the point that you know, more of it is homegrown in the United States than Europe. And that, you know, in a way, that makes the job of the Fed easier, I think, compared with the job of other central banks. Because, as I said, if you think that part of your high inflation in America is caused by strong American demand, well, that's something the American central bank can do something about. They can raise interest rates and they can cool down that demand. If you're Europe, and none of your inflation is really being caused by strong European demand, but you still have very high inflation and you want to do something about it and you're worried about expectations getting entrenched, the risk is that you raise interest rates, but all you're really doing is slowing down your own economy and you're not really addressing any of the root causes of high prices.
Did you just say the Fed has it easy? I love that.
they would make a difference.
Jay Powell's calling. He has a little problem with that.
You know, Ben, though, you spoke to a lot of interesting people here. Jason Furman at Harvard was one name that jumped out at me, who's an economics professor there. Just wondering, like, of all the people you spoke to on this one, what really popped for you? What was an insight that you didn't know going in?
I think something that really jumped out at me was what Jason Furman said about the way that the world economy has kind of flipped in the pandemic. So the problem used to be that, you know, there used to be an abundance of goods. There were plenty of goods, and the problem that countries have was to find buyers for those goods, to find demand for it. And so, you know, in that story, the bad guys are countries like Germany, for example, and China that were running big trade surpluses and sort of piggybacking off of other people's demand. But in the pandemic, this has kind of been flipped because now goods are not abundant. You know, they're scarce. And in that world, the American trade deficit, you know, it used to be that the U.S. was the kind of world's consumer of last resort. When America ran a trade deficit, this helped other economies. And now that's kind of been turned on its head. When America buys a lot more stuff than the rest of the world.
Right. Yeah, it's makes you wonder how it plays out. Jill Weber, Ben Holland, thank you so much. Check this out in the new issue, upcoming issue of Business Week.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
There's a story we wanted to bring you since it hit the Bloomberg terminal last week. It's about the noted short seller Carson Block. And I got to say, it's very telling and a very revealing story.
And perhaps that's why, and I mentioned that it, you know, quote unquote, broke Twitter, of course, an expression meaning, you know, when I log into Twitter in the morning and see what people are writing about, this was certainly one of those things. Katya Porchansky is U.S. News legal team reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from New York City. Katya, I want to get to the crazy anecdote in this story that I think, you know, is one that certainly needs to be explained. Yeah. But first off, we're talking about Muddy Waters founder Carson Block. Who is he?
So Carson is a really interesting character on, I wouldn't say he's on Wall Street because he's in Austin, Texas, but he's a short seller, meaning like he's known for putting out bearish reports on companies. And he has delisted, or his reports have gotten 8 companies delisted over the course of his career. He has a legal background, a finance background. He's really well known because he made his name going after Chinese frauds, a space that not many people were looking at, and there were a lot of Chinese frauds, and so he was like right about a lot of these. And he's just become really famous in the space over the last 10 years, making his firm, which started as a research shop, now into a hedge fund.
Right. And I feel like he's very well known to the Bloomberg audience. And when he often writes about something or puts out some research, you know, you often see a name move. You mentioned he's been right about a lot of names. Has he been more right than wrong in his trades? Because I feel like when we, you know this, Katya, when we talk about a short seller, it feels like everybody gets so nervous, but it's another side of the trade. So bottom line, has he been right in a lot of his research and his calls?
He has, but
complicated.
It's complicated, and there's different types of short reports, right? That exist. There are ones that are saying that a company is overvalued, and then there are ones that say this company is a fraud. And what he and his firm do specifically is they really try to go after ones. I mean, they go through a lot. They do a lot of different types of short reports, but they're well known because they pick out frauds, and they have, you know, they do this like forensic analysis, and they go through all this trouble, and they have researchers around the world, and they coordinate with a lot of people, but they've been under a lot of heat lately. And, you know, there's a lot of chatter about them and what they do as an institution, and not just them, but in the short market in general, the way they go about doing their work in a more controversial way.
Right. Well, sometimes you do your work under duress. We have to get to how you start off your story. And I feel like it's very telling maybe about who Carson Block is, in that he shared with you a very revealing and very personal story. Do you mind going there in terms of how you kick off your story?
Sure. You know, so we went down to Texas to meet with Carson and get a little bit of an understanding of how he does his work. And because we have written a lot about a DOJ investigation into short sellers, and have reported about Carson being a person and his firm being one of the firms that are being looked at by the Justice Department for potential market manipulation or coordinated trading. We're not exactly sure what precisely the DOJ is looking at this stage, but they have taken an interest in a lot of firms, and Muddy Waters is one of them. So we went down and we wanted to know more about, you know, the Wild West of short selling and what goes on there. You know, a lot of these firms aren't, you know, they're a little bit different from the traditional hedge fund managers that that we may all be more familiar with. They're more buttoned up or whatever. And these are a lot of independent researchers that sell their work to funds and move markets. So we wanted to know a little bit about what that life was, that world was like, and asked if, you know, he had any experience with wrongdoing in that space, you know, CD practices. And he talked very openly about a time that he believes he was front run by, you know, an individual that he suspects leaked his information, the information about an upcoming report. He was on his way to present a short on Tal Education at a conference. And on his way on the flight, he saw there was a mysterious interloper in the market building a position that would profit off of him getting up on stage and saying, go short this position. And it was such a stressful moment that a hemorrhoid burst.
Well, he was on the flight.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there, which is a perfect reason that you want to go read the rest of this story, because it's just, I feel like it just gives you an indication of kind of the pressure, the intensity of who this person is. Katya, we got to run. Katya Porzakonski, she's U.S. Legal News team leader. Check this story out on the Bloomberg.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
And we've got just about 10 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. And as Charlie mentioned, we are at our lows, or just off our lows, when it comes to the equity trade here with a few minutes to go. Outperformance, though, Tim, we are seeing it in the energy and materials names, bottom of the pack. Healthcare names, they're down about 1.7%.
All right, let's get into it with Chris Zaccarelli, Chief Investment Officer at Independent Advisor Alliance. Chris joins us this afternoon on the phone from Charlotte, North Carolina. Chris, how are you?
Doing well. How about yourself?
We're doing pretty well. Look, we're not debating right now 75 versus 100 basis points because, you know, we're not hearing from Fed speakers, and it does seem like 75 is going to be what it is. Still, though, there's a lot of consternation when it comes to the global macroeconomic environment, with energy crisis and playing out in Europe, and of course, inflation crisis playing out here. How do you see things?
Yeah, I think that's about right. I mean, we're in the Fed quiet period, and 75 basis points looks to be what we're going to see next week. I think that's what everyone was pricing in prior to those really high CPI prints. But if you looked at the Bloomberg implied probability for the Fed rate hikes, to your point, 1% was only for a very short period of time when people had that knee-jerk reaction. But ultimately, we think a lot of the same headwinds are with us right now that we have at the beginning of the year as far as inflation continues to be a problem. The Fed is going to be raising rates and tightening financial conditions, and you're continuing to have those recession fears. I think today is very illustrative about what's happening in terms of a recession on the horizon. Mm.
So if I look at since the beginning of the third quarter, so I'm looking at since the end of June, if I look at the S&P 500, so the big cap names, Chris, your outperformance so far this month has come from consumer discretionary. It's up 5.6%. Information technology. So, you know, we're talking about growth names. They're up more than 3%. Communication services, financials, consumer staples. I mean, it does feel like high-vol stocks are all of a sudden we're seeing outperformance. You have told us you feel comfortable putting cash to work. Where do you feel comfortable putting cash to work in this market environment, and what seems to be some changes in where we're seeing outperformance?
Well, we've definitely been dollar cost averaging. I don't know that we've been comfortable trying to pick a bottom, but we've absolutely been putting cash to work. We've really tried to just stay with a balanced portfolio. We've been balancing between value and growth. We've been recognizing the fact that with the market down about 20% year to date, that offers value. But we haven't been trying to predict when and if we're going to hit that bottom. We do think a recession is more likely a little farther down the road. We're not quite as worried about recession in 2022 because of the strong consumer spending. And you've seen a little bit of that in the consumer discretionary stocks. I think if you heard a little bit of the Bank of America commentary, they talked about how spending has remained strong.
Right.
But then you have that news out of Apple today about employment, and that's really the other half of the picture. And so we do think that there is a recession more likely in 2023 or 2024.
Okay.
But ultimately, you know, you kind of have to take advantage of the levels that you have at the time you have them.
So I appreciate hearing your macro views here, but I do wonder where you know, ultimately you've got to figure out where to put your clients' money to work. So where do you? You say this balance between value and growth. What more specifically, what sectors, where are you doing it?
Yeah, so more specifically within the value side of things, we have been adding to some energy names over the last few months. We're looking within oil and gas. We do think having an inflation hedge in the portfolio is important. We've also been looking at some consumer staples in order to make sure that we have some more resilient earnings on the value side. On the growth side, we're looking for those larger tech names, ones that have sold off a lot, potentially could go down farther, but we think have durable businesses. And ultimately, if you have
like Netflix, which has really been beaten up, and we're going to get a check on their results, is that a name that you feel confident enough to play into?
We more stick with probably the larger tech names in terms of like Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, some of the bigger players that have those bigger franchises. Without a doubt, Netflix is a large company, but we view Netflix as both an entertainment and consumer discretionary play, not just a technology play in the typical hardware or software way of thinking.
So Apple, which came out and really brought the market down, our Mark Gurman exclusive about them slowing hiring and maybe where they're going to be investing as they look at the economic outlook, that's down 2%. Is that a buying opportunity in your view?
It all depends on your time horizon. If you have, you know, a 1 to 3 to 5 year time horizon or longer, absolutely. We think Apple at this price is going to provide really good returns going forward. But if you're a trader, you're looking over the next couple of weeks, even for this year, it's going to be challenging. Clearly, day by day, as the news comes out, there can be more downside ahead. And if we go into a recession and it's a deeper recession, then most of the stock market is going to go out farther. It's impossible to know on any given day how soon that will happen. And again, if you have a long enough time horizon, we think there are a lot of good companies on sale right now. And I'm sure we're not the only ones thinking that way. But it all depends on your audience, right? If you have short-term traders versus longer-term investors.
When you say there are a lot of companies on sale right now, how are you valuing them? Are you valuing them based on what their earnings are, you know, what they said about forward earnings lately? Are you valuing them? Like, how are you getting to that price where you're saying they're a good value?
So for us, we're typically, again, longer-term investors. We're not necessarily going to look at what this quarter's earnings are going to be, what this year is going to be. We're looking more franchise value, so kind of looking over a whole cycle. You find those companies with great franchises. I think Apple and Microsoft are great examples where, yes, cyclically their earnings could be down if we go into a recession. But if you think over the next 5, 10, 20 years, we think it's very likely they'll continue to grow those earnings. So we'd be looking more at earnings over the last, let's say, 5 to 10 years, projecting, you know, through a full business cycle going forward, less so quarter by quarter or even, you know, calendar year.
Where don't you want to be?
So right now, we still think you don't want to be in those speculative names, those ones with either extremely high price-to-earnings ratios or ones without price-to-earnings ratio because there aren't earnings. If we are going to go through a recession...
Do you ever really want to be there, to be quite honest?
With our... In our investment style, no. But I do understand that there's a time for momentum. There's a time for speculation. We think if there ever was a time for that, that time has passed. You won't see that again until we actually are in recession.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Wow. Hey, listen, we covered a lot of ground. And when I said, do you ever want to be there? Tim's like, yeah, you know,
well, I mean,
investors
you
were
did
there.
Want to be there, yeah.
That's true.
You wanted to be there until you didn't.
Right, exactly.
The problem is a lot of people don't know when, you know, when to pull from those,
it's
right?
It's always in the timing, right? Chris Eccarelli, thank you so much. Chief Investment Officer at Independent Advisor Alliance, joining us on the phone from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.